It's been at least a decade, probably a year or so more than that, since my first venture into this business of preaching as a layperson with and to this congregation at First Church. Back then, I was, for a number of reasons, moved to consider, largely as an antagonist, what I believed to be the problem of prayer for Unitarians. Never mind the arrogance of speaking in such a forthright manner about what might be a problem only for myself. I was full of the Spirit in ways that humanist lapsed Christians with a chip on their shoulder can probably understand. I won't dwell on how I happened on this attitude, which lies deeper than an academic grudge against a certain kind of forced metaphysical need, or how I came to bear a certain grievance about needing to pray in general. And in particular, I had a beef against that condition that puts you in the way of having to pray under duress, prayers that feel extorted from us by what sometimes feels like a perverse providence. We've all had moments when it feels as if the control of our lives has slipped away. Whether or not you're at some point of hitting bottom is less important than the affront to one's dignity. Never mind the many questions one could raise as to the what and the to whom of prayer on any level. Under such circumstances, even the how is ultimately beside the point. For me in those days, it was almost entirely a matter of feeling oppressed, but what felt as if my life had come apart, and then I had reached the point of desperation, which is when needing to pray has urgency. I was out of sorts, out of gas, and out of options, reduced to the great ouch of feeling helpless and needing something that I absolutely didn't have. At the time, I had been in something like recovery from my divorce in 2002, and like many who have struggled in one way or another with the course of their inner lives, I had a backlog of resentment about what I'd come to think of as a kind of spiritual extortion. I had accepted responsibility for my role in my breakup, having been humbled by my share in failures of forgiveness and compromise, and thoroughly chagrined by the implacable ways that character and personality create realities we find difficult to change or completely understand, at least in time for that understanding to forestall the inevitable. In my case, the back end of that process had been exacerbated by economic factors that had contributed its own surplus of bad vibes. Business was bad. My life was a mess, and the combination had me, for a few months anyway, bouncing off the ropes of a low period in my life. In the aftermath, as I recovered and my business and personal lives regained their customary equilibrium, I took a kind of emotional sabbatical, went through a period of study, including a fairly intensive investigation of the arts of intimacy, including the theology of dialogue developed by Martin Buber, that extraordinary Hasidic philosopher, in his book, I and Thou. In particular, I was moved by Buber's conception of soul-making that flows through the processes of deep conversations with other people, wherein the I-Thou relation becomes the pure encounter of one whole and unique individual being with another, an encounter that takes place in circumstances of relationship wherein each partner is both active and passive, and where each is affirmed as a whole person, fully formed. Only in this relationship is the other truly an other, and is only in the encounter, experienced in dialogue, that the I becomes as genuinely and as complete a person. That was then. As for prayer and meditation, the issue should have been more of a settled affair, resolved by reconciliation years ago with my own doubts. I would say unequivocal unbelief, but that would be to exaggerate the confidence I have in my capacity for certainty. I remain more or less permanently conflicted, neither a deist or theist, nor entirely or at least confidently an atheist, I persist in living at the cusp of several unsatisfactory modalities of faithless faith. In one way, this position lends itself to considerations of faith as a corollary of skepticism. For example, if we look closely enough at the structures of our thinking, we realize that knowledge and certainty are all provisional, subject to review and change as we learn more or uncover what lies beneath the surfaces of our impressions. So that being absolutely positive or negative about almost anything except stupidity itself is in all likelihood a symptom of that malady. Very little categorical can be said about very much, whereas doubt becomes the great teacher. Then there is the matter of the otherness we attempt to plumb when we delve the dark of prayer, into that space outside of us that is somehow not outside, that presence that we often intuit in our relation with the world. We overhear this presence in the familiar patterns that we recognize as having form and meaning, when the fabric of our surroundings makes more sense than usual, when correlation means more than we can explain, so much so that we're convinced that we're part of the fabric. How else to explain the alignment that we found? We overhear this presence in that silence that follows having taken ourselves into the privacy of that dialogue we only have with ourselves. And then only when the interior life is organized enough to remember, to think about that matter or other of importance. We overhear this presence, and we may even find a way to speak to it, provisionally if you're a Unitarian. But perhaps more than we might otherwise, we accept the sound of its voicings as if they were indeed someone's. What we do with this intellectually is something I at least rarely admit to. That is giving the cliche its due as my own version of the still small voice. I would argue that most of us have an interlocutor of the imagination, our companion when we talk to ourselves. We may even take ourselves by surprise and dig into a conversation with the old boy or girl. But prayer, which in its authenticity is much more than this, at least I like to think so. Not sure I'm entirely qualified to judge. But then I'm not sure anyone is, except a saint or a spiritual adept who makes his living in the warmth of the kindly darkness of a spiritual path. Prayer is more, and ultimately it is transitive, at least in the structures of motivation and impulse that drive the act itself. In this case, I find myself agreeing with Anne Lamott, who writes that prayer is the setting of a sacred intention. And this last word, intention, is where you might find its active ingredient. Prayer aims for something. It operates from a condition that has not yet been attained, and that at least at the moment of utterance may even be contrary to fact. I'd like to think that prayer moves toward a condition describable in terms of betterment, and in many circumstances, its intention is to bring or solicit comfort. In most circumstances, we pray for someone and or something, and it is in this voice, and it is this voice that turns in the direction of that presence and power that I spoke of earlier. In most cases, from the vantage point of powerlessness, or at least a condition that needs strengthening. In its simplest, not to say primitive forms, prayer asks for protection or improvement in the conditions of life, or else it's offered in the wake of receiving some good or benefit, speaking out of thanksgiving. The question of how the sacred portion of its intention is applied is where its energy comes from. And it's that thing which distinguishes prayer from the ordinary psychology of asking. To be sacred, something has to be held as intrinsically valuable, The sacred has to be set apart and held in high esteem. What do we do when we set a sacred intention? We frame our objective in a zone, if you will, that is deserving special attention. It may be powerful or fragile. It is very probably beautiful. If it is what we want most of all, it must be made of love and certainly worth an act of prayer. Recently, I've begun revisiting my spiritual life as a Unitarian Universalist, and I've been surprised to find myself occupying a kind of middle ground between the congenial, momentary, and experience-driven framework of meditation and the more intentional and task-oriented postures of prayer. Not that in prayer I am backsliding into some kind of theistic wish fulfillment, but that I have become interested in what prayer betokens. I found myself asking what it is that prayer is really about, and the answers I find are, to my surprise, not at all what I expected as a humanist. Meditation, on the other hand, involves itself in the processes of thought itself, and in that sense, it is reflexive, an act of mind watching itself. In meditation, we attend experience and mind its flow and name its elements to ourselves, noting the data as it forms in and becomes part of our consciousness. Meditation is about being present. It is the here which notes the passages of breath in and out of my nasal passages and lungs. It's what I notice when my lungs are full and when they are empty. It's the presence of mind that notices the arrival of sense experience, the here that knows the feel of the breeze on my skin, the here that notices the slightly excessive warmth or coolness of the room. It's where we note the slant of light and the ambient sounds of our surroundings. Meditation is note-taking for and by our conscious minds, whereas prayer is busy getting something done, or at least seeking out or making something not here be made present in the span of our attention. Prayer has to do with will applied to the fate of something that is devoutly to be wished for, and in some ways making it happen, or projecting the objective of making it so. What then does it mean for a humanist to pray? Does it even make sense to go there, to take on the operation of the cognitive tools associated with prayer? Is there any point of differentiation that needs to be developed between attending to the present moment, such as we apply in meditation, and that overt asking for something of the universe that I associate with prayer and the utterance that supports it? I am and have been quite capable of composing what amounts to a kind of artificial prayer. That is, of prayers as poems whose shape is given by the addressing of another, a spirit of life or the universe, as it were, a power. And if we're Unitarians, this will be more presence than person, but that we carry on the mode of address as if that other were in fact a being that we can address. It all works formally and fine as long as I maintain a suitably aesthetic perspective. There is a decorum to this kind of artificial praying, even and especially when it's serious. Unlike meditation, which looks inward, prayer is mostly outward-facing and can be thought of as at least potentially theatrical, in the sense of a will being applied against an adversary, that presence that I spoke of earlier. And because as a Unitarian Universalist, we're believers in plain speaking, this kind of impersonation involves a bit of playing with the rhetoric, if you will, of prayer-like utterance, without taking on in any serious way what would otherwise be an awkward theology of prayer for a humanist. That said, I have to confess that I have found myself using this secular form of prayer as a way of reframing sacred speech, so that now I'm far less sure myself that prayer is in fact, not possessed of a kind of transitive power. Because as any cognitive behavioral therapist will tell you, the talking cure of utterance actually can help to shape the mind's intentions and form a frame for perception itself, just not one that can be considered in any way supernatural. Meanwhile, in church, we have heard Thomas and others appropriate in our joys and concerns a near cousin of prayer, which for many is the more congenial modality of shared meditation. The reasons for its success among more humanistic Unitarian Universalists are simple. Spoken meditation can almost completely avoid referencing a transcendent other, as the voice of the service leader becomes a vehicle whose prayer and vocalization are overtly united in a collective process of paying attention to the moment. Even if the form of the meditation itself is premeditated, fictive, and essentially artificial. Spoken meditation is one of the few genuinely shareable forms of individual spiritual practice. For me, it bridges the frontier between what has always involved some kind of encounter with the otherness of the universe, the not-me, if you will, of the mind at work, especially of a sensibility that it considers its own contents to be in some way, for a few moments at least, time outside of time, universal and at least for the purposes of imagination, eternal. Present on the other side, we mustn't forget that what we have is what each conscious person possesses, which is both boundless, universal, and ineluctably individual and finite in the personhood that each of us possesses, whose depths are nevertheless inexhaustible and mysterious. The distinction from prayer in this spoken space is found, I think, in its enactment of presence. Religious traditions, of course, recognize both prayer and meditation, and I don't want to suggest that there's any real chasm between these two forms of spiritual practice. Nevertheless, as we heard in Milosz's poem, prayer can serve as a kind of bridge between the individual and the universal, between straitened contingency and a release into the freedom of something airborne and unrestricted. In its primitive forms, and here I hope I'm not being inadvertently offensive, for which I apologize. For we say in the traditional forms of theism, prayer is the means by which the individual addresses the Almighty, who may be as close to you as the breath in your lungs, as Islam teaches. Whereas meditation is about thought which either minds itself in silence or in its shared and vocalized disposition enacts its passages in order that utterance brings to otherwise less articulate thought. I won't try to parse the limits of thought, such as those posed by what psychophysicists have called the functional moment, in which the smallest segment of time that we can recognize as the now of the present has a duration of about 3 seconds before there is a perceivable and inevitable transition to the next now moment. Defining thought usually is fraught with complexities in the details of what we mean by the word and how we are able to watch the mind as it experiences its environment. But for the purposes of this conversation, let's agree that thought as such has content and flow and in certain respects a beginning, middle, and end, much as sentences do and paragraphs. It isn't really the case, but that's another matter for another morning. There is, as well, the fact that we all live, there is as well the fact that we live and what we can report concerning that experience is in many respects a function of selection. If we truly pay attention to the senses, we are overwhelmed by the sheer pressure of life's throughput. Thought and mindfulness are contraptions for selecting the telling details. The skill we bring to this editorial act is the stuff of learning. It's what differentiates the sane person who has some measure of the flood of being and the person afflicted by their minds who have no such apprehension and no way to filter the flow. The question persists, however, that I find myself still needing to compose the odd prayer, understanding that there is no mastery implied. Prayer, in the condition of the secular, is a loaded questioning. We can only give way to it if we recognize that we too are entangled in the flesh, which is a humbling state of affairs. But conditioned, of course, by skepticism and doubt, while at the same time, I'm in general more or less at home with a view of meditation as focused thought, then on a good day I'm able to muster almost successfully in the midst of my writing life, sharing with my heroes Montaigne and Kierkegaard a disposition to put my conscious life down in writing. My hope is that in the end I will eventually make sense of it all, perhaps later in the act of reading what I found back to myself and back to my friends. Amen and blessed be.